This is Sending Signals, a show about music and creativity. I'm your host, Matt Royal. Welcome to the show. Our guests this month, Ash frontman Tim Wheeler and record executive and Gentle Giant frontman Derek Shulman. Ash are a band from Northern Ireland, somewhat defined by two periods of success. Their debut album in 1996, entitled 1977, went top of the UK album chart and spawned indie rock anthems such as Girl from Mars, Oh Yeah, Angel Interceptor and Goldfinger. Their follow-up Nuclear Sounds was less well received, but the third album in 2001, Free All Angels, once again saw the band at the top of the album chart with a string of successful singles. Ash are currently celebrating a new compilation and tour, 25 Years of Ash, and I caught up with Tim Wheeler in the lobby of the London Hotel to discuss the band's history and future.
Alright, hello, hey, hello, hey, hello.
I'm here in a luxury hotel.
Yeah.
With Tim Wheeler.
Stylish, chic boutique hotel.
So you're just saying you had an early start?
Yeah, I got up at 4 for, we were on Chris Evans' breakfast show this morning.
Yeah. Yeah. So, five songs,
yeah,
including a cover.
And of those five songs, the cover was Twice as well.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you covered Buzzcocks' Everyone You Love. Is that, is that your favourite Buzzcocks song?
I love I Don't Mind, Fiction, Romance. There's a ton of them, yeah.
I really like Why Can't I Touch It, but it's more because bands have covered it.
Yeah.
Lamb Chop did a great version.
No way, I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, and Rival Schools covered it as well.
So wicked.
That's a song that like crops up, which is really fun.
We also did we did it for Shaun of the Dead with Chris Martin on singing a bit of a chorus.
Oh, okay.
Hang on, what tune is it? I don't know. I got up too early this morning, but there's another big Buzzcocks song we did that is out of my mind at the moment.
Is there anything you'd like to cover that you haven't yet?
I kind of have a big list, but there's a lot of kind of obscure stuff. Yeah, someday I think maybe, you know, it'd be fun to do a covers record.
Were Ash playing covers when you first started? Did you learn to play by playing covers? Or did you have original straight off?
It's kind of, we weren't really good enough to play covers. So so we started writing our own stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, I never wanted to do that. When I was in, I had my first band when I was 15, and it was like, we ended up playing a cover of Moni Moni, but it was mostly just a vehicle to play our own terrible songs.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it
money? That's great.
Is it a bit tenuous promoting 25 Years of Ash in 2020? Because you're kind of older than that.
Yeah. Well, I think I guess the label wanted some kind of snappy tag to show how long we've been around without. I don't know. They thought it'd be a good anniversary, but I guess it's like 94 is when the first record came out.
Yeah.
And Darkest Hour of the Night, the latest song on it, is from 2019. I guess it's 25
works.
Years of music, but yeah, really, in real fact, we've been around since 92, so so what's that, 28 years of Ash, really.
Do you have like a start date for Ash?
I've got it somewhere in the calendar. It's like the date of our first rehearsal with Rick, so I know the exact day we were born, and it's in May or June 92.
Did you foresee
it was in my diary somewhere, so
really?
Did
you foresee it being a 28 year project?
Definitely not, no. Yeah, no way. Yeah.
Does it make you think that we could be sitting here in 20 odd years talking about 50 years of Ash?
Yeah, I hope so.
That'd be so cool. Yeah.
I don't see any point in stopping now.
No.
Yeah. It's cool. We were at the label the other day and I was like, they're also putting out the Supergrass compilation, and they're, you know, they're from 94 or something to 2008. And I was like, wow, we've, a lot of our contemporaries, you know, even the ones who've reformed, you know, they've split up a bunch over the years and had long hiatuses and stuff, but we've always just kept going, so I'm really proud of it.
It means you can get taken for granted, though. It seems like a lot of this band's like Spoon.
Yeah,
it just kind of
Spoon,
it just keep going and keep being great.
Yeah, yeah.
But you wonder, would it be better if they'd split and had come back and were brilliant? It's a funny odd thing, isn't it?
Absolutely, like, yeah. But I figure, I don't know, I've heard Charlatans talk about this as well and say, you know, it's just, well, you could, you know, stop, but, you know, if you split up and you have a dramatic comeback and you play bigger venues, but I don't know, it's kind of, there's something consistently playing a certain level over the years is, you know, it, I don't know, just all these years we would have missed out on and a bunch of the albums wouldn't exist.
And it, it puts so much emphasis, it makes you defined by success as opposed to the art.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
As well.
Yeah.
It's like you can get really big, but then what? You've still got to live and you've still got to do something and be something.
I know, yeah.
And so if...
No, we're fully committed.
If a band means something, why would you stop? But I guess you can take it for granted. I guess there's been, I get the impression there's been points in the band's history where you've been at low ebb.
Yeah.
So would I imagine that, it seems pretty clear in Nuclear Sounds you weren't in a good place.
Yeah.
Was Twilight of Innocence a similar kind of thing?
A little bit, yeah. Actually, yeah. It was definitely a bit of a tempestuous time. Yeah.
Lyrically, I think that album, it hints at some stuff.
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
There's this kind of sort of trying to triumph over, like, adversity or something.
Yeah, you're right. You're 100% right, yeah.
But you don't want to, like, imagine everything is autobiographical either, so it's like...
No, that was a big shift in my life, right? At that time, like, when we moved to New York, and I went through a pretty horrible breakup. And, it was our first record without Charlotte as well, and... the whole record industry was kind of changing dramatically too. So, there's a lot of uncertainty, you know, going in that record. And, it was a very cathartic record. Like, I remember playing it live and going, I don't know, especially playing the song Twilight of the Innocence live. I was like, okay, this is kind of getting me through everything.
That's the highlight of a record, I think. I think there are moments that I wish Ash had explored more. There's Incoming Waves, which is your Sigur Rós moment.
Yeah, yeah.
And the title track, Twilight of the Innocence, where you've gone a bit more epic. I kind of wish...
All right.
I wish you'd sort of sometimes push yourselves into sort of...
Yeah, well, that's good to know, Okay, all I need is a bit of encouragement.
Yeah.
It's fun, you know, to explore that. The new record's a bit all over the place in explorations, but not in an epic kind of way. But it's not too late. Maybe I'll... write something.
Is it weird? So you've put together a compilation 25 years. Is it weird trying to recontextualize everything? So you've got songs with Charlotte, and you've got the early stuff, which is quite lo-fi.
Yeah.
I mean, even 1977 sounds strange. If you listen to it now, it sounds really lo-fi.
Yeah, I know.
It sounds cool, but it's how did this do so well in a way? Because it sounds.
Yeah, actually, we were because we had the same producer as Oasis on that, and. I was on the radio this morning. They played "Roll" with it.
Yeah,
I was like, "Whoa, those guitars are really gnarly sounding."
Well, murky.
Well,
murky.
And that was Owen's style, really. Yeah, I guess in the studio, he was just, everything was cranked up so loud, and and one of our PR guys came along when we were recording 1977 and was like, "This sounds." I think he was talking about Goldfinger. He's like, "This sounds like a demo," and like Owen wanted to kill him, and he was sort of intimidated out of a studio at that point. But
sequencing it when
it was really hard. We had a few different like approaches to it, and eventually I think we sort of realized that okay, we can't just front load it with like all the hits, because then I don't know, you need to, we sort of had to like pace them to like get the flow between everything. And not my favorite thing about the whole new thing is I'm hoping it'll like draw attention to some of our other
lost
songs that we think are some of our strongest ones, but just aren't as known. So, I was kind of trying to balance it, everything, and keep the pace, but sort of, keep just, you know, those sort of hits coming enough regularly that it keeps the flow going through the whole thing.
So this is a question for a band that quit making albums for a while because the album's dead. In 2020, releasing a kind of... A compilation in the age of playlists and streaming seems even seems somewhat potentially, I'm not saying it is, but it seems potentially to be even more redundant than making an album. So where's the motivation?
Actually, it's kind of the, like in the last couple of years, we like signed a new deal with BMG and they bought all our back catalog from Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
And we did a best of in 2010 or 11 or something with Warner's, but they kind of just put it out and did absolutely nothing with it. And so, I don't know, we sort of felt that was a big wasted opportunity. And or, I don't know. So, sort of BMG having spent a lot of money buying the catalog, they wanted to start, you know, putting out like new vinyl editions and stuff. And they kind of, I guess they kind of somehow think this will like help boost our streaming as well. You know, this gives like people a really good introduction point to listen to. I guess it, someone could just make a Spotify playlist, but
yeah,
I don't know. We sort of remastered stuff to make it a more like coherent, flowing experience to listen to, and then our agent was like, "Well, you do greatest hits, you can do a, you know, it's really, it's often people love to go see greatest hits tours and stuff." Yeah. So he wanted to book a massive tour, and I don't know. It just, I personally would have loved to have kept going and put out a new album this year and kept, you know, keeping new stuff going, but I don't know. It's, for me, it's like, it seems there's sort of a lot of external reasons to do it, and if it boosts our profile up again, and
it means sort of flows, the next album does better.
Yeah, exactly. That. For me, then that's like totally worth it. And actually, you know, it's been, I think so far, it's, I guess just the really hardcore fans, it's, apart from the new song, there's, you know, they probably got most of the tracks, but I guess it's to sort of, it's a good chance to draw in sort of fans who are, or maybe
casual,
yeah, casual, or maybe you were only sort of fans of the really early stuff who might come back on board.
Yeah, how do you feel when you listen to sort of stuff from Trailer now? Has it make, has it make
I used
feel?
To, yeah, well, I used to find Trailer was, I used to find the recordings, they kind of bugged me a bit because, like, they were our first time in the studio. We didn't really quite know what we were doing.
Yeah.
And so, but anytime I've sort of coming back around to listen to them, you know, and I like it. Like, I really, especially the three singles from it, Petrol,
Uncle
Jack
Pat
and His Planets.
Uncle Pat's lovely.
Yeah.
It sounds great. Yeah. I think, yeah.
It's a very simple song, but it's great. Yeah. Actually, I really like all those weird early records. Like, yeah, Nuclear Sounds is a really weird record to listen to nowadays, sonically and everything, but in 1977 we could never recreate that sound nowadays, I don't think.
Can you quantify what Charlotte brought to the band?
I guess it like added just a whole dimension where, you know, it could sort of write in a different way and, you know, figure songs out in a different way in rehearsal with her. She's like, you know, such a great versatile guitarist, and then, you know, she's really good keyboards as well, and her backing vocals added a lot. Visually she added a ton, and it was
she looked a lot cooler than all of you.
I'll take that. That's all. I agree.
Can you clear something up? Did you ask her to leave because you went to be a three piece again, or was it more complicated than that?
It's a bit more complicated. I don't know, part of it, like, you know, there's also, she had her solo stuff that was starting to develop, and she had a separate manager, so there was like, I don't know, it seemed to, there's kind of a bit of difficulties, and, you know.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like I remember recording Meltdown, and Charlotte was, she was hard. She wasn't there that much because she was also doing her own, her own solo album at the same time. And,
yeah.
Well, I don't know. Yeah. It's, and then we were sort of, you know, moving to New York. It felt like it could have been a good time for a good change, really. But
yeah.
I don't know. I sort of, I would kind of love to have her around still, to be honest, and, you know, would be, she is still so cool. We got on great.
Good.
Yeah, so, you know, really admire her.
Can you describe what happened to you when Shining Light came out? Because sudden, like, if you had music television in that era, you kind of crossed over, like, MTV, The Box. It was this sort of, it kind of just seemed to cross the board, and suddenly your mum liked an Ash song.
Right,
and
that
it just, your face in that video was suddenly
everywhere.
Like, how did that, what happened to your life when that happens?
Oh, well, I guess it was a big relief, because not many guitar bands had been doing well in a year or so before. Like, there was like there's kind of a lot of, maybe big American bands were doing okay, but the UK side of things, there was definitely like, it was all the radio was getting a bit more poppy, like S Club 7 kind of stuff. And it felt, I don't know, we were sort of lucky that we were coming back at the same time as all that stuff like the Strokes and White Stripes was kicking in again. So there was like a whole bit of a rock and roll resurgence.
You've had Radiohead have done Kid A.
Yeah, yeah.
Pulp have done This Is Hardcore.
Yeah, exactly. So
it's kind of the, you know, sort of the sort of a hard stop on that.
Yeah, that era of, yeah.
Like, alternative rock.
Most of our contemporaries were either getting dropped or, you know, breaking up kind of thing. So we. So it kind of, it was to have like another big wave of success was amazing. And also like the whole time with 1977 was brilliant, but you know, I found the pressure hard and I didn't enjoy it as much as I should have. You know, like I was just kind of stressed out the whole time.
You took on exhausted. Too much, didn't you?
I think so, yeah. And then, so with Free All Angels, I was like determined. I was like, if we get another like big shot at this, I'm really going to enjoy it this time. So I really enjoyed that whole second wave of success.
Is it frustrating now when you release an album like Kablamo, which is a great it's a fun record, but it didn't have, I mean, I remember I was probably about 12 years old when 1977 came out, and I remember just the artwork was everywhere. You'd go into Woolworths and there'd be posters for it, and the sort of cultural impact of that record and of course Free All Angels. Is it frustrating when you make an album that maybe I don't know if those albums feel any different, the albums that made the impact, if they felt any different to you than making any other album. Is it frustrating when you just can't predict what's gonna happen?
I think it's but I think that's everyone has to deal with that, like U2 probably just when their albums came out there was always such an event, and now you know, it's just like, I don't know, nowadays you hardly see album reviews anywhere or, you know, that much. It's sort of strange to grab people's attention. It's a very different kind of thing nowadays. Yeah. So, but I use the experience that we've had from the past to make them the same way. It kept, you know, I still try to put the focus and the effort in as if it was going to be a big event. You know,
right?
That's how I try to write it, and that's the quality control I want for sonically and everything. I want it to the records to be stand up. You know, if it came out, they'd be fighting for number one or something, you know, in my mind. Yeah, it's frustrating, but I don't know. I've sort of also learned to just, like, have zero expectations nowadays, and if something goes well, it's a bonus. So.
I wondered about writing. Has your writing process changed from the mid-90s to now?
Yeah, well, in some ways, I don't know. The last few years, I've been doing this thing where I do kind of brainstorming writing sessions where I try to write 10 songs in 10 hours, and maybe do that, you know, once a week for a few weeks, and then take a break for a while, and and then I go back and I work through the ones. But I don't know. In the past, I used to like just be pick up a guitar, you know, when I get a little moment and try to write. And I don't know. I'd have sort of half finished ideas. I sort of try to get slightly further in the writing process when the idea is hot. I try to, you know, write, like, get it all together a lot quicker, because once the moment's gone, it's kind of hard to get back to it.
Did you write differently when you decided to release 26 singles, like once every 2 weeks? Did you write differently knowing you were trying to write a single each time?
A bit, it was more like, well, we wanted to make everyone a bit different I was definitely, I really love when I listen back to any of A to Z stuff, because I love the production, and we're a bit like a factory though, because, you know, we had so many to do.
Yeah.
But we were just like kind of following any whimsical idea we had. You know, we wanted to surprise people every couple of weeks. So that was, I don't know. Some of it, I'm like, maybe, you know, there's some great songs in there. Maybe it was not my best songwriting, but in some ways. But I love the production and the style and the vibe so much. So I don't know.
Yeah. I think I saw you on the tour. You came to Southend on the tail end of that tour. Yeah. You played Chinnery's.
Yeah.
I was front. Wicked barrier to that. So that was cool.
Chinnery's is a fun venue.
This is an unusual question. Do you ever regret changing your logo after the second album?
We were talking about this yesterday, and Rick was like, imagine we'd never changed the logo. You mean after Nuclear Sands? Yeah, because we're kind of using the Nuclear Sands one a bit at the minute.
Oh, yeah.
And we're kind of rotating with it and a new font. like there's this lenticular artwork where there's, it sort of rotates between a picture of us from 95 and a picture of us.
Pistols.
Yeah. So at the same time, the logo flips, and we're like, that Nuclear Sounds logo is kind of really cool, actually. And in a circle, we've never used it in a circle before until now, and it's actually quite cool. But yeah, I don't know. Our manager was always like, well, it's a new album, new vibe. Let's change the logo. And it sort of, I don't know, always symbolized a new era. And we always felt with each album that we were going to a real different new place.
That's fine. But yeah. I
know what you mean.
I love the aesthetics of that, you know, those early singles, you know, Goldfinger and all that.
Yeah.
Like with that logo and the imagery. And it was the same with, you mentioned like Iron Moist. You know, Oasis had the same thing. You know, that logo, first three records.
Yeah.
Embrace on the first album, because there were so many singles coming out, bands would put out so many singles, and you'd get this aesthetic that would run through the singles and the album. And you know, Blur kept the same logo
they nailed it,
and it just and your logo is as good as Blur, or you know, the Different Class Pulp era logo. It's one of those,
and the Nirvana logo
sort of 90s logos. That original Ash logo is just, it's very,
I think we sort of felt it was like so kiddish, you know. It's like, because Mark did it in a kind of kiddish scrawl on purpose, and then we sort of felt, well, we're trying to like grow up a bit here, so that was one of our ideas for moving on. And I don't know, maybe we'll bring it back on the next record.
You should.
Yeah.
Self-titled record with that logo.
It'll be all really epic songs.
It'll be your statement. It'll be your Sigur Rós statement record. Yeah. Was there ever a discussion about Lost Domain being an Ash record?
Not really, no, because I think because it was so personal and kind of so, I wanted to experiment a bit in a different kind of way.
You couldn't have made it the same, but I wondered if, I was thinking about the last Arctic Monkeys record.
Yeah.
Which doesn't sound like a Monkeys record.
Oh, yeah.
But ostensibly, it still is. They just worked in a different way.
Yeah.
And I think that's really exciting and totally valid.
Yeah.
And I wondered, sort of in hindsight at the time, did you ever consider, well, I could still get, you know, Rick to play these parts. I could still, and it would, did it occur to you?
No, I think it was like, I think I really wanted the challenge as well of doing it. Maybe the freedom of not having to make it sound a certain way. I think it was kind of an important part of how it ended up the way it was.
And maybe getting sort of people to take a fresh blank slate look at it as well, like from a critical viewpoint, perhaps.
I think so.
It's like, that's Tim Wheeler's solo album. So what's this? And like, it kind of, it's like, rather than quite another Ash record, like, this is a different thing, and maybe take
totally,
it.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah.
And it was kind of hard to make, though, because I've always relied on the guys as my sort of filter musically, like for all my ideas, you know, that kind of help me arrange, choose which songs to focus on, and then we jam them in rehearsal. That's always like where we really workshop the songs and they kind of come together. So I didn't have that making the record. And actually, the one thing Mark really helped me sequence it at the end, I sent him the tracks because I was kind of stuck on the order, and I think I pretty much went with the order he came up with for it, which was cool.
How important is creativity in dealing with grief?
I think it's very, you get the catharsis with it. It's sort of, it's a bit of extra pain as you work through it, because you live with the issues a bit longer than you would. I guess you're sort of facing them a bit more.
Yeah.
But then I think, you come to an understanding with, you know, what you're trying to grapple with. And
is that because is it forcing you to articulate what you're feeling?
I think so, because Flostomania, you know, my dad had Alzheimer's, and I realized there were so many different aspects of it that I kind of wanted to talk about, or, you know, it was only really when I got, like, the last song I did for it was this one called Sheltered Youth, which was on like a sort of EP as a bonus track, and that was like the very end of the record. I was like, there's still some stuff I want to say about my dad, and it's kind of about, like, you know, growing up in the Troubles in Northern Ireland, and kind of the shelter that, or kind of the protection that I guess I really had from him, you know.
Yeah.
I was growing up in, during a kind of crazy time, but I felt very safe, and so that was like, I kept sort of finding aspects of the story that I kind of wanted to tell. So
I guess this goes back to why write songs in the first place. I mean, when you started writing songs, is it because you find it easy to express stuff in song than it is to talk about it? Or is it just because you love music? Or
Yeah, I guess it's like a... It's a good way your subconscious does come to the surface. Like, actually, I think, when, you know, I got my first guitar and then, like, a few weeks later, my grandmother died. And so then I was like... I do remember, like, writing a riff around that time that I played over and over. But it was, like, kind of... I was like, oh, all right, this is... This is like a kind of sad piece of music. It kind of summed up my feelings. So right from the get-go, it was like, oh, this is a way of like expressing the stuff I don't know how to express.
Yeah. So you've already started on the next record.
Yeah.
Have you started recording it, or are you just writing it?
Actually, it's pretty much recorded except for vocals haven't been finished. So right. Actually, there's some, you know, just lyrics I need to finish, but it's all like pretty much tracked.
Does it sound?
It's really all over the place.
Yeah.
In a slightly uncomfortable way, but I think it's actually really good. Like, I think every song's really strong and quite a different style. And yeah, I heard a great Bowie quote the other day where he was saying, as an artist, you want to be slightly, feel like you're slightly out of your depth.
Yeah.
And that's when you're doing something good. So I was like, that gave me comfort. I was like, okay, we're in the right place there, you know.
Danny McNamara said from Embrace, was on the show, and he said to me, it feels like every album he does now, he wants to be one that he'd be happy to finish on.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
Understand it, because that means you're aiming for like the peak quality.
Yeah.
But then that's a lot. It's a lot of pressure as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like,
you never know when you're
when you might be might be done.
When you might run out of time. Yeah.
Do you think your masterpiece is still ahead of you?
I hope so. Yeah. Yeah. It'd be cool.
Do you know what you want to do? Like, have you got, right, 10 years from now, have you got something in your head that you think you might be able to make?
I don't have any like particular goals. Like, I don't know. I guess I'm sort of like enjoying the process without worrying too much. Maybe can't tell if it's a good or bad thing. I don't know. Always just trying to find something new and strong. And sometimes it's simplicity is like the best stuff, you know?
Yeah.
As well. Because I don't know. A lot of my best stuff is just arrives accidentally.
Yeah.
Just from doing things. Like, I've never... I don't know. It's when I'm kind of writing a lot often, and I'm kind of just in the zone, and it's finding something that is real and resonates.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I've kind of stopped overthinking it a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've definitely...
Well...
I trust the process.
Well, listen, have a great tour, and I hope the new record comes together and comes out and does really well, too.
Thanks. Cheers.
And... I'll listen with interest.
Yeah, and, cool, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on, Tim. It's been great.
Great to be here, thank you.
Thanks, mate.
While you're here, if you haven't already subscribed, please do so. And if you could leave a review on iTunes, it really does make a difference to a new show like this. Thank you. Gentle Giant have a mammoth new box set out. The 30-disc set charts the full history of the band from 1970 to 1980. If you're not familiar with the band, they formed out of the ashes of 60s act Simon Dupree and the Big Sound, who had a hit with the lovely Kites. Frontman and multi-instrumentalist Derek Shulman, his two brothers and their new bandmates set off in search of more progressive heights with the formation of Gentle Giant. If you've worn out your favourite Yes and Genesis records, Gentle Giant are surely your next step. Following the disbanding of Gentle Giant, Derek became a prominent record executive, signing the likes of Bon Jovi and Dream Theater, and he was kind enough to come on the podcast.
Well, we've kind of chatted and made friends, so I'm going to say welcome to the show, Derek.
my pleasure. Speaking to Southend-on-Sea for the first time in many, many years.
I saw you have a new box at Unburied Treasure, and I saw you were just talking off air about you went to an unboxing thing in New Jersey the other week. And I watched the video, and you seemed really surprised how nice it was.
Yeah, no, well, I was. I mean, honestly, because it was put together, you know, lovingly by some, you know, people at Snapper Records, and we were obviously party to it. But there was, again, not something I was you know, had seen before, and this was the first time that we all had unboxed the box, if you like. It's what a strange statement here, but it was, yeah, it was the book itself looked, it's superb, and the touring book looks great. I mean, all the bits and pieces in there, and there are, I believe, 16 live albums and 11 recorded albums and all sorts of, you know, goodies and who knows what else is in there. But it's a beautiful package, and I was surprised how nice it is, even though it's there's a limited edition. I don't have one, and I didn't hear the music, obviously the live music, should I say, but there's the recorded music there, which I hope it sounds good. I haven't heard them, so you know, when I hear them, I will be either pleasantly surprised or you know, crying in my beer.
Is it strange to have so much of your life documented in like the pre-smartphone age? I mean, now everything is documented, but I think it's strange for bands in particularly the 60s, but obviously also the 70s, that there's so much of your life documented either by photos or recordings, and that's quite an unusual situation to be in as a human, you know.
Yeah, well it is. I mean, you realize that, you know, your life is not private, and especially if you go on stage, then you're in the public eye, and you know, but that's the life we chose, and I'm glad we did, because you know, at least it was something that we it wasn't just checking into a factory and living a life. It wasn't just a roller coaster. It wasn't a merry-go-round. It was a roller coaster. Yeah. So yeah, it was yeah. So the fact that our lives have been public during the period of being in a group as musicians, and subsequently since then, and my side, you know, being involved in the music business, and Ray and everyone else, you know. So it's, you know, thankfully I've been able to enjoy what I've been doing to make a living, if you like, all of my life.
Yeah,
which I'm very lucky about.
How do you describe the band when people ask you what Gentle Giant were like? How do you describe them?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Describe the band. It was a combination of various members whose backgrounds came from different arenas of music. Kerry, the keyboard player, was a graduate of the Royal Academy of Music, studied under Cornelius Cardew, is very, very classically trained, I mean, and a superb composer. Literally, I mean, a classical composer. My brother Ray was also classically trained on the violin. But in our household, in the Schulman household, my father was a jazz musician and a band leader. So music was always around our house. And I was, you know, I could read and play sax and bass and everything else. But, you know, my love was R&B and soul music. And there, and Gary Green came aboard. He was a real blueser. So it was a combination of all sorts of personalities who came with their various loves of their own music. And we all got it together and stirred it into a pot and put it in a funnel, and out dripped Gentle Giant.
What questions do you get bored of being asked about the band? Because I notice a lot of the interviews end up being quite similar that you do. Is there stuff that you get bored of being asked?
You know, I never get bored of answering questions, because it's or any kind of questions. I mean, before you hit record, your record button, you ask me a question that I'd never been asked before, and I have to tip my hat to you. What's my day like? You know, that was very funny, and actually sort of got me on my heels a little bit.
Good. I'm pleased about that. Except I forgot to press record.
Well, I don't I often get asked that question, actually. As I said to you, just to get back to the questions I don't get answered, or asked, if you like, my day consists of getting up, having breakfast, making calls to Europe, because I'm involved in European labels, record labels, if you like, or music labels. And then I go to the office and have meetings about other artists and labels. And then I'm doing interviews for Unburied Treasure to Southend-on-Sea, which is what I'm doing now. But get asked what you know, is this there? If you listen to the album interview, which is almost a bit of cynicism to a certain degree, which I, you know, we should never have as a band. There's the questioner, Phil Sutcliffe, who worked at Sounds Magazine, kind of asked those questions. And we were trying to, in our own tired, cynical way, to say, okay, you know, here we are being a band that, you know, we're fairly popular. And even though in a quasi-cult fashion, so who's gentle and who's giant, you know, and how did the band get together and et cetera, et cetera. So, and the question you just asked, actually, about how did it get together and how did it become what it was? But I'm happy to answer those questions because they're never, never too old or too hackneyed to answer, because a lot of people, you know, still want to know what it is that puts a band together. It's chemistry as well. I mean, and the people who are in the band have to literally fit into a slot that's a jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah. I didn't actually ask her. I asked how you describe the band if someone asks, I guess in terms of what you sound like. Yeah.
Okay. Well, describing the band, you mean musically?
Yeah. Yeah. If a band comes to you and knows that you were in a band in the 70s and you have to sum up what you did, how do you describe it?
That's a good question, because that's a very good question. And in fact, we are bagged, if you like, into the prog world.
Yeah.
I think we were a really good rock band.
Yeah.
End of story.
Do you remember the statement of intent that you put in the second album inlay, where you said that you were it was your goal to expand the frontiers of contemporary popular music at the risk of being very unpopular, and that you'd abandoned all preconceived thoughts of blatant commercialism. And I think it's pretty interesting now that you're in the music industry. I wonder how you'd react if a band came to you and wanted to put that in the inlay. If Dream Theater had said, we want to put that on the inlay of Images and Words or something, how you would react from sort of the other side of the fence, you know?
Well, let me just rebut that statement. That wasn't me that said that. That was my older brother, Phil. So let's be clear here. And that was his statement. That was his statement, not mine. And really, it was a little bit pretentious and pompous to say that. But nevertheless, you know, in some respects, in our defense, in his saying what we said or said in whatever that meant, was that we were never followers. We didn't listen to this band and that band and say, man, we should be like this, or, you know, we should sound like this. We were who we were, whether it was commercial or uncommercial. To say in the interest of commerciality actually didn't make sense, because, of course, if you make a record, you go on stage, you want people to see or listen. And because if you just want to play music, just do it at home on your own instrument. For the fact that we went on tour and got on stage and made music for people to buy, of course we wanted to expand our audiences. That makes no sense to make that statement. However, what it was attempting to do was just to say, look, don't expect us to be like Joe Schmo and the Blows, you know, because we're not. We're a gentle giant.
Yeah. Is it? So here's a question. It's a tough one to answer. I know there's no answer, but I wonder, do you believe it's harder to write a complex, multifaceted piece of ostensibly progressive music, or do you think it's harder to write a pop hit?
Ooh, that's an interesting question too. Well, I mean, for both to be of any success, or any commercial success and or musical success, they're both hard. I mean, you know, they're both very, very difficult. There are only so many chord progressions, if you like, in the pop area that make the sound good. And unfortunately, in this day and age, they're usually committed to these computer scientific analytics, where certain things work and certain things don't, and certain producers have these things at their fingertips so that they know that scientifically what the coda and or a breakdown will sound like, which is a whole different animal. However, you know, to make a gigantically popular song big and or a piece of music that is scored and sounds good and is popular also, they're both difficult. I mean, it's not a walk in the park. You know, yeah, you can make something which is good or okay, but great, no, it's difficult on both ends.
Yeah, it fascinates me. I'm a big Genesis fan, and obviously it's easy to like pick on them for sort of going commercial, but the fact that that band were able to make something like Supper's Ready and to sort of top the charts with Invisible Touch, it's like, actually, is having a hit single with Invisible Touch easier than like making an epic prog track? You know, surely both it's remarkable they did either, you know? And I think
good for them.
Yeah. I wondered if being in Gentle Giant and Simon Dupree before that, do you think it made you a better record executive, or did it make your job harder? Or is that...
No. It actually made me a lot better, actually, because number one, there was not a band that I worked with ever that could say, well, you don't know what it's like, because I did and I do. And you know, I slept under buses or in cars or in a coach or you know, toured in a plane or whatever, and played the smallest venues where one person booed me off, and played the venues where 30,000 people cheered me on. So there wasn't a situation where any band could say to me, you don't know what it's like. But also at the same time, I was able to use my, I guess, experience in the world that I was in to at least guide and help my second career, if you like, in the sort of the music business or the business of music world, to guide as much as I could the artists I wanted to work with and saw potential in commercial success to see their dream, if you like, or potential being realized. Yeah. So I think it was a very positive thing.
Yeah. I was born in 1983, so I obviously never saw the band play. No. I didn't make the Palace Theatre show in 1971, sadly. But
did your dad or mom?
No, I don't think they did, no.
Oh, shame on them.
I wonder what could I have expected from a Gentle Giant live show, though?
Surprise.
Really?
Yeah, shock. Surprise and surprise number one. Enjoyment number two, and walking out of this after the show with a smile on your face.
What would have surprised me?
That we weren't taking ourselves personally as a music group on stage too seriously. We presented our music, complex as it was, with a lot of fun and a lot of enjoyment, and we wanted to transmit that enjoyment we had on stage to the audience. So we were good musicians. Yes, we were. And enjoy what we enjoyed and smiled at the audience and did look down and puff our music out with lots of long, you know, mellotronic padding and pretend we were some, you know, LSO or Luciano Pavarotti, you know, taking ourselves so seriously that it was insane. We wanted to have fun.
Yeah.
But also at the same time to play good music. So I hope that translated to the audience.
Yeah. Have you ever come close to reforming?
No.
Do you regret not doing it? Like, I'm not saying you'd want to do it now, but maybe when the band were still a bit younger, did you ever regret not doing it again?
No, not at all. It was a chapter. It was a chapter where, you know, again, you're my son's age, and so he's had a couple of jobs. He's working at Sony, actually, of all things, as a creative director. And that's a chapter in his life. And you have chapters in your life where you'll have the zenith of creativity and drive and various other things, and that'll close, and then another chapter opens. So your life is not one thing, and I don't want to replicate. I wouldn't want to replicate what I had done, because it's history, and history can't be rewritten.
You seem happy to help promote reissues and stuff, though.
Yeah, well, I am. Yeah, because it's... happy the fact that at least I'm happy that a new audience, if you like, an audience of your age, if you like, have the slightest bit of interest in the music that we finished and recorded and live music that we put together. And 40 years later, if you like, or 35 years later, whatever it is, it's still, I guess, to a certain degree, meaningful. I mean, a lot of music is here today and gone tomorrow. We didn't think about that when we were putting it together. It was just for our time. And the fact that it's that it's still viable, if you like, is surprising to us. And in fact, if it's viable, then why not help spread the word that it's okay to enjoy it, even in our old age?
Yeah. The box set includes the Roxy Show from 1980, which I think was your final show.
That's correct.
Did you know at the time it was going to be your final show?
Yes.
So was that did you announce it? Was it an emotional night? What do you remember?
No, because at the beginning of the tour, myself and Kerry, announced to the band that we didn't want to carry on to tour and to continue. And Ray, we all agreed that this, we had a European tour coming up, but it was time. Was there any kind of emotional? No, it was, you know, it's like checking as I said, you write a book, you end the chapter at the end, and then you close it and move on. You know, it was, again, it was great fun, but it was just one of those things. If you like, you know, I don't have any kind of, those were the days, or let's cry and spill beer and drink champagne. Or no, it was just, okay, that's the end of the tour. That was a great run, then let's move on.
Yeah.
It's pretty simple.
So your final album, Civilian, the Wikipedia page for it says that the negative reaction being so overwhelming that some record stores reportedly refused to carry it for fears of generating bad publicity. Is that true?
No, I think that's nonsense.
Okay.
That's complete nonsense. No, in fact, I quite, to tell you this, because that's one of my more, I like that album. I think it's a good album.
It is a good album, yeah.
And it's very undersung by a lot of the fans that love, you know, Gentle Giant, but it's a different album. It's not, doesn't have time signature changes. There's no key changes in the middle, or there's no sort of like stop start stuff. But as an album itself, I think it stands up very, very well, and it sounds good. And honestly, you know, I know some of the band don't like it. It was a hard album to make, I have to say this, but I think it stands up. And had we, you know, again, your conjecture and hypothetics, had we continued, who knows what we would be now? I mean, again, I could be hanging out with Jay-Z or Kanye, you know. So, that was another extension of where we were going, but it didn't continue.
So I'm
going
to briefly ask you about three different songs and just tell me anything you want to about these songs, anything that comes to mind. So first one, Giant.
The Birth of a Realization. Okay, that's the opening line from what I understand. Remember, anyway. The start of Gentle Giant, effectively. This is it. Here we go. Let's see where we go.
Yeah. You still proud of it?
Yeah, I am, actually. Because it said, literally, that first line was... I'm doing an analogy of writing a book. Once upon a time. Okay. So that's effectively what that line says.
Yeah. Okay. Next one, The Power and the Glory.
Quite a good song, actually. Done as an appendage to the album, The Power and the Glory, but not part of the album.
Yeah.
The thought process was that we stick it on, maybe because we were actually very, very popular in during that period as headliners. And that album, The Power and the Glory, was actually one of my favorite albums to make and one of my favorite albums that I listened to. And although it didn't have a quote, you know, hit single on it. So that was our thought process about putting that song as part and part as the package of maybe having a song that could get on the radio, but we didn't actually issue that as a single ultimately. But again, that was a thought process.
Okay.
Not bad. Quite liked it, actually.
Because I read something that sort of implied it was a bit of the label wanted a single and you did it as a bit of a joke and they put it out and then had to recall it. And is there any truth to that, or is that a thing that got distorted?
No, there's so many distortions in or people's minds that think that we're doing one thing and we're actually doing another. No, it was something we did. And we weren't forced. The one thing we were never, thankfully, ever directed was to do something that the record company wanted to do. Everything we did, and we will take full responsibility, good, bad, or indifferent. So, you know, so whatever, whoever the fans are that says, oh, the record company made you do this or that. No, it was the band. So if we did something the fans or non-fans didn't like, they blame the band. And you know, it's what we decided to do. And if it worked, it worked. But it obviously didn't quite work the way we wanted to.
Shadows on the Street.
Ooh, that's an interesting one. That's on, what album is that?
What's Civilian.
Civilian, yeah. Kind of almost a dark song that that was, yeah, in certain respects, the precursor to the band breaking up.
Yeah.
Not, you know, knowing that this is getting towards the end of the creative process.
Yeah.
That comes to mind as I'm thinking about the song itself, which is like kind of like you floated that by me. And I'm in my mind, I'm hearing it again. Yeah. Effectively, that's kind of just coming. It's almost a Rorschach test to do here, but in my mind. So that's the vibe I get personally.
All right. Well, listen, one final question. It's a silly one, but did your brother really jump on Yoko Ono's bed in Abbey Road Studios?
Yeah, and I did too. Oh, it's true, of course. Yeah.
I gather she wasn't in it at the time.
No, but she came by. She said, get off. Yeah. We have all sorts of stories that I'll spill in my book one day.
Yeah, I'll look forward to that.
Okay.
I've got to let you go, man. Our half hour is up, but thank you so much. This has been fun.
Okay, my pleasure. And fun to be too.
Take care of yourself, mate.
Yeah, thanks very much.
All right, bye.
Okay, all right, bye-bye.
Bye.
That's our show. Thanks this month to Jay Taylor, Sharon Chevin, and Matt Broughton. Until next time.